Okay, notice the other review sessions. Eugene's having a session tomorrow afternoon. I think he emailed you about that. 2 to 4 in downstairs from our lecture room. Andrew and Connie will do the one on Sunday evening as normal. And then Haley will do one on Monday evening. There are some people who, because of the holiday and so on, are taking the exam on Wednesday. So be sure not to blurt out what you found on the exam to these people. And for them, if they have to be away on Monday evening, they can. Haley will run a session on Sunday evening. Haley will run a session on Monday evening. But you can't come to both. You can't get an advantage by putting it off. Okay? Does that make sense?
What if you can't go to the Friday one?
Yeah.
Well, that's too bad. You can't have everything.
Can we just leave Eugene for like later?
I think we'll have to let Eugene handle that.
Because like people have perspectives as well as like
Yeah. Okay. Good. So anyhow, this is here are the here are the topics we've studied. Hassan, I can't hear very well. Well, we'll start talking about carbonyl groups, which is chapter 16, but it won't be on the exam. It'll be on the next exam, though, the final exam. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Or did you have some?
I just have a quick question. Are we still meeting during reading week?
Oh yeah, not on Monday.
Not on the last Monday before.
There's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in reading week. We'll meet on Wednesday and Friday, but I have to be in Sicily on Monday, and in fact, I have to be in Sicily the previous Friday too. So we'll have the two lectures Friday and Wednesday and Friday of reading week. Those two lectures, yeah. Now,
Can we go over the concept of rotating frame and why that?
Yeah.
Why we need that?
Yeah, the reason you think about the rotating frame is because there's this phenomenon that works. You have an applied field, you put in a radio field who's magnetic. Bear in mind, this is magnetic resonance, not electric. So the part of light that you're interested in is its magnetic field, not its electric field. Okay, so the magnetic field is perpendicular to the applied field. And whereas the applied field is steady, the perpendicular field is oscillating at 100 megahertz, typically, okay, or whatever frequency. Okay. Now, to try to figure out how you're going to behave as a magnet, if you have a big field like this, but also this other field, so in fact the field is going, you know, it's complicated what the real field is doing. So to figure out what magnets are going to be doing in that field, what the nuclei are going to be doing, is a tough problem. But somebody had this insight that if you rotate, right, then the steady field looks, then the field looks as if it's a constant field. Because if you rotate, it cancels out the applied field. That is to say, what the applied field, the big field, makes things do, makes protons do, is precess at 100 megahertz. But if you go into the rotating frame, they look like they're standing still. And now the effect of these two fields is superimposed one on the other. So if you cancel the one out, now all you have to worry about is this 100 megahertz thing. Okay? But notice that the 100 megahertz is oscillating back and forth, fixed in the machine or in the laboratory frame, as it's called, going back and forth like that. But as we look at it, we're going around. So how does it appear to be doing? It's always pointing in the same direction, because when it's pointing this way, you're over here. Then when it's pointing the opposite way, you're over here. So it's always pointing toward you. Now, true enough, it's not steady, right? Because it'll be always pointing toward you, but it'll be strong, then weak, then strong, then weak, then strong, then weak. But it's always toward you. So what if you're a proton, precessing that way. You see a field that's always in this, if you're in the rotating frame, right? You see a field that's always in this direction. It's sometimes stronger and sometimes weaker. You're going to precess about it, right? A little bit faster, then a little bit slower, then a little bit faster, then a little bit slower. But it's happening 100 megahertz real fast, right? So it sort of averages from your point of view. So what you're going to do is just precess. So understanding the effect of the superposition of these two fields is ever so much simpler if you look at it in a rotating frame. So there's nothing that really rotates. I mean, the proton precesses and so on. But understanding what it does besides just precessing in the applied field is very simple if you just take the point of view of your rotating, right? So then for the point of view of thinking about this, you can go back and forth. Look at it for a while from one point of view and see that if it's precessing about a horizontal field, it's going to be going like this. But now you can go back to the laboratory frame and see what that means is that the protons that are going like this are actually going to then be going like this and then come back and be going like this, right? And if you give a 90-degree pulse in the rotating frame, then the average, bear in mind that there are a whole bunch of protons that are magnetized, some of them pointing with the field, some of them pointing against the field. But they're in all different phases of rotation, which is why their horizontal components, the part that's varying, cancels out from one to the next, so you don't get any field. But if you rotate, if you make them precess just enough that they've turned on average 90 degrees, each one has turned 90 degrees, so the average of all their magnetic fields is now horizontal. Steady in the rotating frame, but precessing at 100 megahertz in the laboratory frame, which means now there is a signal coming out. Right? There is a going back and forth on average because all of them, they cancel out now these components, but they have all reinforced in that component. But only to the extent that there were originally more up than down. Right? You've turned them like this, and because there are a few more this way than this way, you get a net field that's this way, steady in the rotating frame, but precessing at 100 megahertz. So you have this antenna that's going that gives off a radio frequency signal at 100 megahertz. Or if you do it at whatever it is, 23.5 or whatever the carbon is in the same magnetic field, then you'll do the same thing to the carbon nuclei. Or you can do it to both of them, both the proton and the carbon. And then you can do it fancy ways, like turn on the proton for 180 degrees and then hit the carbon for 90 degrees and then hit the protons for another 90 degrees and so on. And they will interact with one another. And that's what's involved when you do two-dimensional, to see how one nucleus influences another nucleus. And when one influences the other, the way you plot it is one of these off-diagonal peaks in a two-dimensional spectrum. So that shows when one thing influences something else. Yeah?
Is that electrical force thing you were referring to earlier, does that apply with IR?
Light is both electrical, bouncing up and down, and magnetic, perpendicular to the electrical. The electrical interacts with charges and moves them, right? Now, if you had an electrical dipole like HCl, right, it's both positive and negative, overall neutral, an electric field would do is push the plus one way and the minus the other, stretch and shrink the bond. And if you apply this typically rather small force, the field from the light usually isn't very big. You can make it, with special lasers and stuff like that, a really big field. And then it really just jerks things around and makes them go the way the electrical field wanted. But usually it's a very modest force. So it has to be, in order to transfer energy to the vibrating molecule in IR, it has to be in phase. Right? It's like using a noodle to push someone on a swing. right? You can't push them with a noodle and immediately they'll go the way you're pushing them. If you pushed them with a, you know, with a baseball bat, maybe you could make them move the way you want to. And that's like using one of these lasers in a really big electric field. But usually all you have is this very weak noodle to push them with. So they're just sitting there, or they're in 0 point, they're going back and forth on their swing. And if you push them exactly at the right time, and keep doing it at exactly the right time, then you can transfer energy to them and they'll go higher and higher. But if you just push them random, sometimes you'll be helping, sometimes hurting their swinging and nothing will happen. So this electrical oscillation of the light has to be in phase with the normal vibration of the molecule, which is determined by the bond strength and the mass of the atoms. So if you get the color, the frequency of the IR light to exactly match the natural frequency with which this thing vibrates, then you can put energy in and make it vibrate at a higher amplitude. Same frequency, if it's harmonic, that is, if it's a parabola, same frequency but a higher amplitude. Or, in fact, you can get energy back out. The energy can reinforce the light and you get more light out than you put in. That's what lasers do.
So what are we measuring?
You measure the attenuation of the light beam. So light comes in, hits the sample, but less light comes out because if it's the right frequency, because the sample absorbs. So you measure, for example, the percent transmission, what fraction of the light got through. Okay? Or you can measure the absorbance, which is the log of the initial of the transmitted light divided by the original light or something like that, or minus that. But anyhow, you measure the vertical axis in a spectrum is some scale of what fraction of the light gets through. Okay, now, but just to continue on that, so the electrical field can stretch the molecule, a dipole. If it's not a dipole, or it doesn't change the dipole moment by oscillating, then the light has no handle on it. And it'll just be transparent.
Like 1s to
2s, yeah. The light doesn't influence that. Even though the light has the frequency that matches the energy difference, it doesn't have a handle. It's like the light has no overlap with that transition. Okay? It has the right, it's energy matched, but it doesn't have overlap to make anything happen. Okay, now another thing light can do with a dipole is that it's pushing the plus one way and the minus the other. Suppose the molecule's oriented like this. You push the plus this way, the minus this way, and it rotates. Okay, that's electrical. Now, the magnetic part of light interacts with magnets, not with charges. And there's some of the wikis were misleading in that. They spoke about the magnetic resonance fields pushing charges. It's not charges, it's magnetic. And you know, there's no such thing as a magnetic pole. You can't have the north pole of a, you can't take a magnet, which is the north pole and south pole, and cut it in half, and here's the north pole, like a positive charge, and it gets pushed that way by the field. Here's the negative end, it gets pushed that way. They always come in pairs because it's not really polar at all. It's a shorthand description of what's really going on. Okay? But it behaves, but if it's in a magnetic field, it'll get rotated to try to make it point with that magnetic field. Okay? So that's what happens to a magnet, and it's different from what an electrical field. It's what an electrical field does to a dipole to try to turn it. And a magnetic field does that to a magnetic dipole. But in the electrical case, there's also such a thing as a positive charge. And it gets pushed. And a negative charge gets pulled. Right? But there's no analog of that in magnetic. It's only things getting twisted. Right? But so the field tries to twist the nuclear magnets to point with it. And when they feel that twist, what do? Well, normally they would follow it. But what in fact do they do? Because they precess because they're spinning. Right? So they go around the magnetic field.
Okay.
But the quantization for these little things is such that if you have a spin 1/2 nucleus, which is the only ones we really talked about, they only have two possible orientations of in a field, not like a compass in the field of the Earth, which can have any point any direction with different energies. Right? It can only point more or less with or more or less against the field if it has spin 1/2. Each precesses at the same frequency, and you can make them go back and forth between them. One's pointing with, one's against. If you put in a horizontal field, it in the rotating frame precesses about that and goes from pointing mostly with to mostly against, and you absorb energy that way. But it's important to realize that there's a distinction between electric fields and magnetic fields and what they do to things. Yeah.
So when you apply the magnetic field, right, and it's causing the proton or whatever nucleus is to process.
Yeah.
And but that, at that point immediately, the horizontal fields are all canceling out. So you don't get...
Yeah, initially they're all canceling out.
So you don't get any signal then.
No, no signal.
But so why, when you rotate it, why don't they still cancel?
Oh, they still do cancel in the same direction, right? They're all around a cone, you got that idea, okay? So that they're all pointing this way, more or less, but some are pointing also this way, some this way, this way. So the horizontal part cancels out. And that's the only part that's changing. Individual ones are changing their horizontal component at a certain frequency. So you'd think a single nucleus would give off light. But if you have a whole set of them, they cancel out. You don't get any light from it. Okay? But they all reinforce in this direction, but that's steady. It's not changing. However, if you put a 90-degree pulse on and make them go like that, now they have a horizontal component with respect to the magnetic field, and they're all precessing, right? And now they reinforce one another. The other ones that were originally against them would cancel when you do that. But there are a few more this way than there are this way. So now you get a signal out after that pulse.
But for every proton that's pointing this way at first, before it gets...
Yeah.
Aren't the others pointing that way too? So when they get the 90-degree pulse, they're not all...
No, they're like this, around a cone.
Yeah.
When you rotate them about this axis...
But they're all going to go around the same axis.
They all go like this.
That's
so they cancel in this direction, they cancel in this direction, they cancel in this direction, but they don't cancel in that direction. And that's the one you're interested in. That's the one that they're now precessing.
But if you were like, if you kept your hand there in the same plane and rotated like 90 degrees that way, there is no proton pointing that way, right?
Pointing which way?
Pointing.
Here's where it started.
Right.
Now, I'm going to understand what they're doing, I'm going to be in the rotating frame.
Yeah.
They go like that. And there were others that were against them, another part of the double cone, that are like that now. So they cancel to the right, they cancel to the left, they cancel up, they cancel down, but they don't cancel in and out, right? Because there are a few more of these than there are of these, and that's the signal that comes out then.
Thanks.
Yeah?
Which signal is it that's being measured? So is it after the...
After the pulse, you get this signal. Now, in time, things will equilibrate again. You know that given infinite time, it's going to come back to be the way it was originally. That was the lowest energy form. Right? So things will get randomized and they'll come back to be like that. Right? So there's a question of how quickly do they come back? Because if you give a little pulse and you get a signal, but then it goes away... this is a little bit different because it's different the way things were originally done. Originally, people didn't use pulses, so I'm going to shift gears just very slightly here. What happened when originally is it absorbs energy, right? Now I haven't given you the picture of how that works, and I'm not going to take the time to do it. But originally it was done like normal spectroscopy, where you put on a radio frequency signal and it absorbs it, right? And when it absorbs it, you equalize the population. The way it absorbs energy is take some of the extra ones that were in the low energy state, pointing up, and make them go into the high energy. That absorbs energy. But once having done that, right, now there's nothing to absorb the energy anymore. Until it comes back to equilibrium, and then it will absorb some more energy. So the physicists who first did this kind of experiment were very worried about relaxation. about how, if it takes too long to get back, the amount of energy you're going to absorb is going to be negligible and you'll never get a signal. So they were very gratified to find that relaxation was fast enough that they could observe the signal. Right? And the same thing happens, same kind of thing with this stuff we're generating here, that it goes away in time. And if it goes away too fast, then you don't see, if this horizontal stuff gets out of phase. I shouldn't talk more about this because you're not responsible for it on the test. But it is relevant to one thing, which is if odd electrons are floating around, they make the relaxation happen easier by making local fields that are different. Don't worry too much about exactly how that happens. Okay? And then, let's take the first instance we were talking about, where the way they originally did experiments, where you can absorb energy for a little while, then it goes away, unless there's a mechanism for relaxing, and then you can absorb some more energy. One mechanism for relaxing is to have odd electrons with their field floating around. Bear in mind, we're looking at protons. This is an NMR experiment. But if you have stray fields from odd electrons floating around, then you can absorb energy more easily. Now, can anybody see what I'm building for with this? What technique depends on that? Where do you get odd electrons floating around in a sample? Radicals don't last. Pardon me? Yeah, in electron paramagnetic spectroscopy, you look at very unusual molecules like triphenyl methyl radical, which happens to be stable. It doesn't couple easily because it's too sterically hindered to couple easily. And the radical itself is stable because of the conjugation with the rings. Okay, so you can do EPR and look at that. So you could indeed, and people sometimes do, put in things like that that are stable free radicals, and they change NMR in handy ways. But there's something else that's very hard to keep out of the samples. These are rare things that are hard to find, these kind of free radicals. But there's another thing that has odd electrons in it, unpaired electrons, that's around everywhere almost, and it's hard to keep out of the samples. You know what that is? It's O2. O2 has unpaired electrons in it. So it does this kind of thing. Now, where does that crop up? Where does that become handy in a kind of NMR spectroscopy? The fact that oxygen influences the strength of the signals. Pardon me?
You're doing the brain.
The brain. What do you do with the brain?
Functional MRI.
And remember how it worked? It's wherever there's a lot of oxygen around, the signals are strengthened because of this, what we were just talking about, this affecting the relaxation. So you have a lot of oxygen, you'll get stronger signal than if you don't have as much oxygen. So what you do is you look at a thing where there is a lot of oxygen, and then the same thing where there's not so much oxygen, and look at the difference and see where did the signal strength change, right? And that's where the amount of oxygen changed, right? So that's exactly what this bold blood oxygen level dependent MRI, right? So then when a neuron gets active, you see stronger signals from its protons. And by comparing that with what was happening before the cell was stimulated, you see where that cell was that was stimulated by looking at donuts or looking at car keys. Yeah?
What's the property of oxygen?
The property of oxygen that causes this to happen is having a magnetic field, a strong magnetic field, because it has odd electrons. Remember how much stronger an electron magnet is than a nuclear magnet? 600 times, 700 closer, actually 660 I think it is. But way, way stronger than protons. So that those electrons really can make a difference in things like relaxation. Yeah?
What do you mean by odd number of electrons?
The odd electrons are electrons that are not in pairs.
Okay.
O2, obviously, neutral O2 has an even number of electrons. Right, because it's two things that came together, whether they were even or odd, when they come together, the total number is going to be even. But there are two orbitals in oxygen. that have exactly the same energy. So instead of putting two electrons in one of those orbitals, it's better to put one in each orbital. And it turns out that it's lower in energy if those two electron spins are parallel to one another rather than canceling. So you have odd electrons, SOMOs, right? So oxygen is magnetic in a way that most molecules are not, except for triphenylmethyl and things like that. Yeah. I can't hear very well.
To build off of Evan's question, we're in the rotating frame, it's like this. So there's more, let's say there's more up than down.
Yeah.
So what happens is that we go like this. If we're out of the rotating frame, though, are each proton, like at any one time,
each proton is, if you don't worry about the rotating frame, what each proton is mostly doing is precessing about the applied field. So they're a whole bunch like this. You put it like this. Now this one is going around like this. This one is going around like this. The whole family is going around like this, around the applied field. So it's just as if the cone were moving intact.
The whole family either in this direction or that direction.
On average, the family is pointing in that direction. But as it precesses, it points here, 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 which is moving a magnetic field back and forth, which is broadcasting light at that frequency.
With Sherry's question.
Pardon me?
With Sherry's question about IR, he said that if frequencies that aren't right, light of the wrong frequency don't work because the net effect is zero, right?
Yeah.
So if you shoot a short enough pulse, then you have really high absorption.
Precisely. If you shoot a really short pulse of radio frequency in an NMR thing, you do all the protons because they all match enough over a very short time. Right? Or if you do the same thing in IR, in fact, Professor Schmuttenmayer in our department does what's called femtosecond spectroscopy, which is he shoots in actually an electric field that just makes one pulse. It doesn't go both up and down. It goes just up. Right? And that's so short that it matches everything. So all kinds of things get excited by that kind of thing. So you're absolutely right. But this is what we talked about in terms of resolution. If you put the wave on long enough, then only things that exactly match the frequency will work. Right? And if you don't go long enough, you can't tell what frequency something is because everything works. So if you want to distinguish two things, you have to have your pulse be long enough that it'll interact with one and not with the other. Right? So that if that pulse takes long enough to get through the sample, and if the protons are jumping back and forth, you see only their average. Right?
One of the tests, there was an NMR spectrum, and it turns out there was a peak for a proton and a hydroxide. How do we know when we'll see that, and is it going to react the same as a proton?
You usually see protons from hydroxide, but depending on how fast they're exchanging from one molecule to another, if it's rather slow, for example, if there's no acid in there and the solvent is something that tends to help them by hydrogen bonding to them, help hold them in place, right? Then you'll see hyperfine split, or you'll see spin-spin splitting. So if there are two protons on the carbon next door, you see three peaks, 1 to 2 to 1. But if there's acid in there, so one proton will come on that one, and that one you're interested in jumps to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, then you see an average, and you see just one peak. If the rate happens to be intermediate between what you'd get for one that's fixed on a particular molecule and one that's jumping among varying molecules, then the signal may be broad. Remember this thing we looked at where you had two peaks at low temperature for cyclohexane? And then as you raise the temperature, it broadens, the peaks come together, and then they become sharp at the average. If you're in this intermediate range, the peak could be so broad, since it's integral the area under it is always the same, it could be so broad that you'd miss it. Right? So the OH would appear to go away. It's really there. It's just under those intermediate exchange rate scenario. It's there. It's just so broad you don't see it. It's not as big as the noise. Yeah, Richard?
Sorry to go back to the rotating frame. Why can't you just measure it before you rotate it? Because assuming there would be more an excess going up as opposed to going down.
But what are you going to measure?
The net magnetic field and the...
Okay, the sample indeed has a net magnetic field.
Yeah.
But that's very tough to measure. Because A, it's really, really small. It's much easier to measure light that comes from a changing field than it is to measure a steady field of the same magnitude. Okay? You might say, if I have more protons pointing up than down, there'll be a magnetism there. I'll bring a compass needle, and it'll point this way, not that way. But the trouble is the applied magnet is humongous, and this little field is nothing. You see what I'm saying? But if that little field is oscillating, then it generates light, and that's easy to detect. I mean, even if it's radio light rather than visible light. That doesn't make sense to you? You don't look satisfied?
It makes sense.
Okay, so you're satisfied. Good. That's our aim. Yeah, Marif?
How exactly is the light generated?
What light comes from radio frequency radiation? What it comes from is changing position of charge. That's what happens in an antenna. Right, when you hook up your computer to listen to the internet, right, in a wireless, there's something in that wireless thing. There must be one here someplace that has a little wire that's making electrons go back and forth real fast, and that's generating radio light or whatever frequency that comes to be detected by your computer. Another way to do it, since light is electromagnetic, is to change a magnetic field back and forth. And that will generate light too. And that's what NMR does.
My question is why is it generating it there and not there? What difference is happening here that's not happening here?
When it's like this, all these are precessing. Yeah. If you had just one,
yeah,
it would precess like this, which says it has a steady field in this direction, but it has a rotating field like this, if it's like this and moving. Okay, it's got a component this direction, but also a changing component this way. That looks like we're golden, right? We got the changing magnetic field, and we're going to be able to put up an antenna and detect the signal that's coming from that, except that you have not only that proton in the sample, you also have a proton that happens to be in this phase of rotation, and they're going like that. And the horizontal field from this one exactly cancels the horizontal field from that one. And this one is canceled by this one, and this one's canceled by this one, and this one's canceled by that one. So you have all of them around a cone, and they're all canceling each other for the ones that are changing, rotating, that could give off a signal. So they cancel. This signal, they all reinforce on. But it's not a signal, it's just a steady field, it's not changing. But if you rotate the nuclei like this with a 90 degree pulse, now they're precessing like this, because always about the applied field. And now the part that's reinforcing is doing the broadcasting. So now you have something to listen to. Okay, I'll close this just so. Yeah. Does that make sense now? Okay. I mean, we don't want to spend all our time on this. But I just think it's interesting to understand how it works so that then you can see what's going on. Yeah?
So, forgetting about physics and literacy, but rotating magnetic fields generate light.
Changing direction, magnetic fields generate light. What actually generates light with a charge is acceleration of charge. If charge is moving steadily, that doesn't count. If it's accelerating, it generates light. And this is something you have to study physics to come to grips with. But that's what generates light, is accelerating charge. If you have something held by a string and you spin it around, that's accelerating. It's not accelerating. It's always got a constant velocity. right? But sometimes it's pointing this way, and this way you're changing its velocity. That's acceleration. Yeah?
Why do we use dilute double labeling as opposed to it's fully saturated?
Yeah, the idea of the dilute double labeling was to correlate two things with one another. Right, we labeled isopentenyl pyrophosphate and let whatever organism it was that makes the compound we're interested in do its stuff. And then we see where the C13s were incorporated in the product, because those signals are much bigger than normal C13 signals, which are only 1%. Okay? But it doesn't tell you, it tells you where they ended up, but it doesn't tell you how they got there. Okay, so you may have a scheme that says, yeah, they should end up there. That's good. It helps support that scheme, and people do exactly that kind of experiment. But a much cleverer experiment is this double labeling thing, where you have two C13s and see if they come in hooked together the same way they were originally, bonded to one another, for example. Because if they're further apart, they won't be coupled enough to see in the spectrum. Okay, so and if this carbon ended up in the molecule someplace, it could be that the original molecule got cut to pieces and that carbon just happened to end up in there in that place. I don't mean just happened at complete random, but the whatever mechanism did it took the carbon here, but it cut away. It wasn't this molecule really that got incorporated. But if you have these double labeled, then if they not only will both appear in the spectrum where you expect, but they'll split one another. And that's why it has to be double labeled. That's why the double labeling has to be dilute. Because if it were very concentrated, and this one ends up there, and this one also ends up there, then they'll both be there, they'll both be labeled, they'll couple, whether they came there together or independently. Right? But if it's dilute, then in any one product molecule, only one of them is likely to be labeled, unless they came in as a group, and then they're both labeled. So dilute double labeling provides more information than single labeling, either dilute or not dilute.
And we can select the carbons we want to label.
In the starting material, yeah. Yeah. And I gave an example of just one particular pair, but you could, in principle, do any pair, but it's expensive and laborious to do it. Richard?
Why does diamagnetic anisotropy, why does it fight back?
Why does it oppose the applied field? It actually depends on how many electrons there are there. I didn't mention this in class, and I don't want to complicate your brain by talking about it. But the first electron will go one way, the next electron will go the other way, typically. So depending on how many electrons you have, the first two go one way, the next one goes the opposite way. I can't remember this exactly, but anyhow, it depends on how many electrons you have, which way, but the general gist of diamagnetism is it opposes the applied field. If it reinforces the applied field, Faraday gave it a different name. It's called paramagnetism. So diamagnetism, by definition, opposes the applied field, and everything is diamagnetic. Only a few things are paramagnetic. The first electrons tend to go one way, and only rarely do you get it going the other way. But both things can happen. And when you do a calculation, some electrons are doing one and some are doing the other. And that's why it's so hard to understand these quantum mechanical calculations of chemical shift, because they involve two big effects that are tending to cancel one another. So it's really hard to understand it. And this idea we talk about electron withdrawing groups, reducing the amount of electron circulation, that seems to work well, so there's probably some truth in it, but to do it at all quantitatively is a much more complicated thing. Yeah. Dre?
I'm curious about when things average to zero and they don't.
Yeah. Well, the interaction of dipoles is easy to understand if you think about lines of force, right? That the effect seen by this magnet is influenced by this magnet, but the influence is in this direction. because that's the way the lines of force go. If you make them one above the other, corresponding to the direction they're pointing, then this one helps, is in the same direction as this one. So it's obvious that it's opposite directions, right? Now, if something changes its orientation to go from hurting, like this, to helping, like this, right? Then averaging those will tend to cancel. If it's only around a circle, then the fact that it's stronger here than here, twice as strong indeed, means that this would win over that on average. But if it's going around a sphere, as in fact two things in a molecule that are connected to one another, if the molecule can tumble any direction, you're averaging over a sphere. And then it turns out, mathematically, that it averages to zero. Right? But that's two permanent magnets, say, that we're talking about, are like nuclei, two nuclei. If the magnetism here is not a permanent thing, but is the magnetism caused by circulation of electrons, then when you change the orientation of the molecule, you may change how much the electrons are circulating. So if it canceled when they were always the same magnitude, it won't cancel anymore if it's bigger some places than others. And that's what anisotropic means, that it changes with orientation. So spin-spin interaction will necessarily average to zero over tumbling because they're always the same strength. But the chemical shift part won't always average to zero. It won't average to zero for the electrons that are going around the nucleus you're interested in, because they're always going around it. As the molecule tumbles, still it's going always the same way. It's the ones that are going around other nuclei that you worry about, right? And that will average to zero only if the amount of orbiting doesn't depend on how the molecule is oriented. Okay? That's diamagnetic anisotropy when it depends. Right, so that's nice, because in general you don't worry about it. You just look at the electrons around the nucleus in question in terms of chemical shift. But the ones around the others will play a big part to the extent that their circulation is anisotropic. And there's several classic examples of things that you can easily recognize will be anisotropic, like the cylinder, the pi cylinder that surrounds an acetylene, or the ring of a benzene ring. Okay, is that to answer your question? Yeah, Mustafa?
An example of a ring of benzene, the electrons are going around like the pi cylinder ring.
Yeah.
What's the other magnetic or magnetic field that we're looking at?
We're in NMR, we're always interested in the field at a proton. That's what the signal tells you, the rate of precession tells you what average field does that proton see. What field does that proton see? The big deal is the applied field that you spent $1 million for, right? But then there are these local fields which can be due to other spins. Other nuclear spins, or to the orbiting of electrons around your own nucleus. That's why we say that withdrawing electrons deshields, takes electrons out that are fighting the field, right? Or electrons orbiting elsewhere, if the amount of that orbiting depends on orientation. And that's, so the electrons going around the benzene ring, as seen by the proton outside the ring, right, has the effect of being deshielding. But if you have any protons inside the ring, it's exactly the opposite, because the circulation causes one direction of field inside the ring and the opposite direction outside the ring. Evan?
Can we see that as like a Lenz's law kind of effect? Where it's like, okay, is that why it's happening? So it's like a wire going around the benzene. Okay, the B field.
Why are the electrons going around the benzene?
Well, that's how we're modeling it. Because it's like the pi field is all connected around.
Yeah, that model is used because of that kind of physics analog. But as I mentioned, actually calculating how the orbital angular momentum of the electrons is a little bit complicated. Yeah. Mustafa?
So you mentioned when we were talking about like the substituent effect on rate, or like with adding or substituting on benzene, that there's a difference between pi and sigma electron like donating or withdrawal. What's the difference?
Yeah, the point, if you want the substitution to be easy, is to make the intermediate stable so that the transition state leading to the intermediate is lower in energy and therefore faster. Okay? So you want to, if you have something that withdraws electrons, that's going to make a cation, the intermediate being a cation, that's going to make the cation less stable and slow it down. If you have something that donates electrons, or another way, a more rigorous way of saying it, is something with high energy electrons that can be stabilized by the vacant orbital that is part of the being a cation. That means there's some vacant orbital there that can stabilize these. So if you have something that donates electrons, that'll make it easier to make the cation. Now, but this withdrawal or donation can occur either in sigma bonds, where if you have a more electronegative substituent, it tends to, the bond is polarized, bigger here than here. So it's partly positive here. So if you have something that's electron withdrawing in a bond because it's an electronegative atom, high nuclear charge, right? Then that'll make it hard to generate an intermediate that has a positive charge here, or indeed a positive charge anywhere nearby if you're withdrawing electrons. So that'll slow it down. But if you have something that donates, it's exactly the opposite. And the same thing for pi electrons, right? Now, the reason you might want to split it into talking about the sigma and pi is because there are some schizophrenic atoms that are electron withdrawing in the sigma system but electron donating in the pi system. So then it's hard to predict what they're going to do. Okay? Give me an example of something that's electron donating, so no question it's going to accelerate the reaction. Pardon me? Yeah, alkyl groups are electron donating compared to hydrogen. Something else that's good that really accelerates the thing.
Oxygen.
Now, oxygen, wait a second. Oxygen's an electronegative atom. It's further to the right on the periodic table. I should think it would be it would tend to withdraw the electrons.
These are the lone pairs on oxygen.
Ah, but they're lone pairs that really can get stabilization from that neighboring vacant orbital. So that dominates, and it's really fast when you have an oxygen on there. How about if it's nitrogen compared to oxygen? Say NH2 instead of OH. Which is going to be more electron withdrawing in the sigma system, oxygen or nitrogen? Yeah.
Oxygen, but
oxygen has a bigger nuclear charge. It's more electron withdrawing. That should slow it down. Okay. Which one has a lower energy unshared pair? So that it'll be a low. Either lower or higher. Which one has the higher energy unshared pair? So that it'll be more donating in the pi system. Nitrogen, oxygen. No, nitrogen has a smaller nuclear charge, higher energy pair. So on both counts, nitrogen wins. Okay, so nitrogen is much better than oxygen at doing this. However, if the nitrogen gets protonated and you have ammonium rather than ammonia as the group, right, then it's exactly the opposite. You don't have the unshared pair to do the trick anymore, and you have a positive charge that's electron withdrawing. So that's not so great.
So the reason we didn't mention NH2 because it's so likely to get protonated?
Yeah. But you can keep it from getting protonated or so easily by putting a carbonyl group on it. The vacant orbital pi star of the CO will lower the energy of those things. Then they don't get protonated so much and it's not as reactive. How do you know? Can you give a specific example of the nitrogen being a strongly activating group? I would think that would be quite memorable. Yeah. What? Yeah, the rocket fuel thing that burned Dennis Tanner's eyebrows off. right? Had he acetylated it, had he put a carbonyl group on that nitrogen, it would still be electron donating, but not nearly as much, and it wouldn't have burned his eyebrows off. Right? So often you acetylate a nitrogen in order to make it more controllable.
So is the reason NO2 is more withdrawn because it's like lone pairs are used up in the bonds with the oxygen?
Yeah, but it's even, if you look carefully, it's even more than that, because the HOMO of the nitro group, the one that would be the one that could donate electrons, or whose electrons could be stabilized, has a node. So it doesn't overlap. It can't be stabilized. Right? So even though other things being an orbital of that energy would be good at being stabilized by the benzene ring, but it can't be because it doesn't overlap. That's the neat lesson of nitro.
And pertaining to that, I was trying to make sense of the slide where you explained this, which is in Lecture 62, Slide 7. I didn't quite understand.
I don't know what it is. Would it help if I put it up so people could see it? Okay, it'll take a minute to load here. Lecture 62.
Slide 7.
Lecture 62, slide 7. That's the one we've just been talking about.
I think it's more of a foundational misunderstanding.
Okay, so just to go through it again, as we were just saying, oxygen, OH, is strongly activating, but nitro is strongly deactivating, which at first naive glance looks backwards, because nitrogen should have a higher energy pair of electrons than oxygen, right? But when you actually look at them, there's the oxygen, and it's got an unusually high HOMO, the same as the pi electrons, so it overlaps well with vacant orbitals there, good overlap with phenyl, and it's a good pi donor. On the other hand, when you have nitro, you have several orbitals to think about. 3p orbitals, one on oxygen, one on nitrogen, one on the other oxygen. It's an allylic system, 3p orbitals in a row. We're going to get 3 molecular orbitals, and the lowest one is going to be like that. And indeed, that overlaps very well. It's got a big coefficient here, right? So it would overlap well with p orbitals, the p orbital of the ring, right? However, it's unusually low in energy, not unusually high. So you're not going to get anything out of stabilizing those with them. We're going to have a vacant orbital here in the intermediate, right? Like if we attack here, take this one out of the system, we're going to have a vacant orbital which is here and here and here. Those p orbitals that'll have this energy, the same. Remember, it's going to be the same energy as a vacant p orbital, maybe a little more so because it's got a positive charge. Okay, but it's way above what you need to stabilize, right? They're not going to mix very much. Not going to get much stabilization. So let's look at the next electrons. There are going to be 4 pi electrons, 2 in that one, 2 in the next one. So the next ones are going to be much higher in energy. They're the same as this. The same as oxygen. Does it surprise you that the energy of this orbital is the same as the energy of an isolated oxygen orbital? Why not? They don't overlap. They are isolated oxygens. Right? There's nothing here to overlap with them. So this one has this energy. Right? So it's rather close to what could stabilize it. So it looks really great except for what? There's no overlap. There's nothing here to overlap with this. Right? So it does, as I said, it's willing to be stabilized, but it's not able to because there's no overlap. Okay? Now, if you go to the next orbital, that one is big on the nitrogen. So now you're going to have good overlap, but unfortunately it's a vacant orbital. So there's nothing to be stabilized by overlapping with the vacant orbital of the cation. So nothing to be gained there.
How do you count the number of pi electrons?
Because oxygen has 2 pairs. Oxygen comes in with 6 electrons, right? So it's got one in this bond, two here, that's five, and in the P, one electron in the P orbital. Okay. This oxygen has one, nitrogen had an unshared pair, okay. So four altogether among these three P orbitals. So you occupy this one, you occupy this one, and the third one is vacant. Right?
For overlap, we're talking about the pi system.
Yeah, with where we're going to be generating this unusually low energy orbital here, when we add a cation and generate this cation intermediate. Okay?
When we say P orbital, do you mean like pure P or like a S, like a hybrid?
No, they're pure P because the hybrids are used in making these bonds and in making the unshared pairs here and here. Right? And it's a pure P orbital that's involved in the pi system. Yeah.
So for any atom, how do we know how many of the lone pairs are in the P system? For example, in oxygen, there's, if it's bonded with two things, two.
Yeah. It's a little bit complicated. Like, if we go back a little bit. Sorry. I went too far back. Well, it's because it's a... Sorry, we got to turn off the automatic advance here. Okay. So in oxygen, often we would think of oxygen having rabbit ears, two unshared pairs, something like sp3 hybridization. But we're interested in overlap with a P orbital here. That's what interests us. Okay? Each of those, one pointing a little bit up and one pointing somewhat down, both of them overlap with this. But if you divide the pi, the pi, P-I-E, differently into a pi orbital, P-I, that can overlap with this, and a sigma orbital, you can divide it that way and have the same electron density. It's just equivalent, but it's an easier way to think about it. It's in that respect like the rotating frame. It's the same thing you're looking at, but an easier way to analyze it. So you can analyze it as if there's a P orbital here that has a pair of electrons and an unshared pair like that. Right. So, but if there were something you were interested in that was out here above, then it would be easier to analyze it in terms of one of those rabbit ear orbitals that's pointing in that direction. Okay.
Well, which one's true?
They're both true. It's just how you analyze it. What's true is the electron density. Right, that's something that you can show by X-ray and so on. But these other ways are just ways of analyzing how well will something interact with it. And you can divide the PIE either way in order to do that analysis.
Yeah. Wouldn't that result in different overlap, though? Wouldn't it be more energetically?
No, the overlap you get, the net overlap will be the same. But in one case, it's overlap with two things. And in the other case, it's overlap with only one thing. And it's easier for purposes of analysis to consider overlapping with one thing than to consider partial overlap with two things. Yeah. Maybe all we talked about was physics this time. But most of the questions have been on physical substances, not so much on the chemical structures and stuff. If I had assigned you a bunch of spectra to interpret, then we'd probably be talking about interpretation of spectra. And that seems to organic chemists more chemical. And arguably, I mean, some courses do it that way and don't talk about this stuff. So you make your choice. Derek?
Yep. Should we memorize the peaks for different bonds?
It's handy to memorize them, right? But it's much more efficient to understand something about the trends and to be able to figure them out without having memorized them. If you become a practicing chemist, interested in doing this kind of thing. Then, at least in the old days, you had a lot of these tables more or less memorized, and you knew that a doublet that appeared at 983 or something like that, denote in the IR spectrum, denoted some particular chemical structure. Right? Nowadays, you don't have to do that as much, because actually, I was going to... I apologize that that email I sent last Sunday didn't get to you, but maybe it was all for the good, because otherwise you'd have had an assignment to do. Okay? But if we look at that thing, if we go to a browser and type NMR spectra, say, I think that Google will find us this. And the very first thing we get, no, not here. Let me say Japan. See if that helps. Yeah, here. The very first thing that comes up is this. This is a spectral database for organic chemists that's run by an institute in Japan, and it's moved its website from the place that Google finds for it. So it's this National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology called AIST in Japan. So this is a compendium of lots and lots of spectra of different kind. It's got NMR spectra, mass spectra, electron spin resonance spectra for radicals, IR spectra, and Raman spectra, which is a different kind of vibrational spectrum like IR, except it doesn't require dipole changes, so you can see peaks that you wouldn't see in the IR. Okay, so if we go to where do we go here? I guess we go down. I agree that I'm not going to download everything you have and publish it. Okay, that kind of stuff. I'm a good person. Okay. I said I agreed. There we go. I guess it doesn't believe me. Does anybody know what I'm doing wrong?
Do you have cookies enabled?
Pardon me?
No, you probably have to enable
JavaScript. Java should be enabled.
Press command.
Please check JavaScript and cookie settings.
Press command.
Oh, I see. Maybe I'm not accepting cookies. Preferences. There. I had my cookies turned off. Okay. No, I don't want to show cookies. I just want to enable it. Okay, so I'm all set. Okay. Now it'll believe me. Thank you.
Do you have JavaScript also?
I don't think it should work. Just a second. Let me check preferences again. Only from sites. Enable Java. Let me try with a different browser. Okay, so it was AIST, Japan. I think it's this database. No, wrong. I have to go back the way where I was before. What did I do? I did NMR, R spectra, Japan. Sorry that I did. I was thinking of getting this thing going before I came over here. Okay, now let's see if it'll believe me. Oops, sorry. Yeah, now we got it. Okay, so this is a thing that helps you find spectra. So that Does anybody have that? The problem I assigned you was to try to figure out what that C13 spectrum was, that which I showed only for purposes of showing how proton decoupling worked. But it had a bunch of peaks, CH, CH3, CH2. Does anybody have it on their computer? I can get it on mine, but it's easier if you get it on yours. Somebody have it? When we talked about decoupling?
The lecture?
Yeah.
Which lecture?
It's probably 61. So, is that black background with green lines on it?
Yeah.
Do you have it there?
Yep.
Okay, tell me where the peaks come. At what chemical shift? Okay, like here it is, right? And along here? It says what the chemical shift is. So this first carbon is at 167 about. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a peak at 167. Now, where else? What's the next one? Bear in mind those are multiplets you're looking at. You want the center of them. 144? 144. No, notice we're letting it be plus or minus 2. Okay, 144. What's the next one? 122. Next. Don't do the one that's the solvent. 60. What?
There's a multiplet.
But what's the center of it? Or after it's been decoupled and it's a single line, then you know.
There are two sets.
18, 16.
The scale also changes when we use higher energy.
Yeah, it's divided by 10. I don't know why. Okay. It's a factor of 10 between them. I think Professor Zilm gave me those things as a demonstration of decoupling, but I forget who gave them to me, and I don't know. I never knew what the compound was, so it's a genuine unknown. Okay, so now I'm going to say search. Okay, I put in those chemical shifts, and it's going to search, and it found these compounds, right, that satisfy that, and it says that I can. If it's got a Y, it says I can look at the mass spectrum. I can look at the carbon NMR, I can look at the proton NMR, I can look at the IR, I can look at the Raman spectrum. It's not a radical, so it's not surprising it doesn't have an ESR spectrum, electron spin resonance. Okay, so let's look at
the last one. You kept throwing me that one.
Okay, let's look at ethyl crotonate here. Okay, so here's a compound. Now, just for practice here, let's predict what the NMR signal of this is going to look like.
You mean the
proton NMR?
Okay.
Well, what we're looked up is C13 NMR. But in truth, you know, you're not going to have just one kind of spectrum, probably. So you're much more powerful than taking just one spectrum and trying to find the thing if you have both the IR and the C13 and the proton and the mass spectrum, which we haven't talked about. All the mass spec does is weigh the molecule, right? One molecule at a time.
So would you use like C13 to confirm your proton?
Yeah,
NMR?
Yeah. But just for practice, here we got a molecule. Let's say something about what you'd expect. Here's some protons.
Yes.
What are you going to look for?
One.
It's a peak up around 1, right, up toward the right of the spectrum, because it doesn't have anything electronegative right next door. It may be a little bit downfield because there's an oxygen 2 away. Right, but there's going to be a methyl, and what pattern will it show?
There are two.
Okay, let's everybody think, and we're going to vote. Think what you think it's going to be. The splitting pattern for this, looking at that signal, the signal of the CG. Okay, it could be a singlet, could be a doublet, could be a triplet. Okay, why a triplet? Because they're two next door. They could both be up. both be down, one up, one down, one up, 1 to 2 to 1. So this should be a 1 to 2 to 1 triple. In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to click and look at the proton NMR spectrum and see whether we got it. So this is going to be up around 1. It's going to be a triplet. How about this one? First, what spin-spin splitting patterns are going to be? Could be a singlet, doublet, triplet, quartet. Quartet 1 to 3 to 3 to 1 because they're three neighbors. Okay, and its chemical shift, is it going to be at 1 like this one? It's going to be downfield because it's got something electronegative pulling the electrons away.
Why is that happening though, that 1 to 3 to 3? Like, how are you...
Because if you have three things, each of which can be either up or down, they could all three be up, all three be down, two up and one down. But there are three possibilities of that. It could be this one down, or this one down, or this one down. Or two down and one up, but there are three possibilities of that. 3, 1, 3, 3, 1. But it's binomial.
Why are they... Like, what is physically causing them to split, though, between...
It's these protons are resonating at some particular magnetic field. That field depends on the chemical shift, the electrons oriented, orbiting around, and also on the field caused by the neighboring protons. In some molecules, all three of those neighbors are going to be pointed up. That'll give one field that these see. In others, they're all going to be pointing down. That'll give another field for those molecules. But then there are going to be molecules that have one up and two down, and molecules that have two up and one down.
Oh, and there are more than
there are. And there are three ways again. It's just a binomial thing, 1, 3, 3, 1. Okay, so and this is, what about chemical shift here, did we say? Maybe around 3, 4, something like that. It's going to be down some. Yeah.
I don't understand how we can figure out relative chemical shifts, but should we just look at some numbers and memorize where they would exactly be?
Well, you know, the more you know, the handier. But I don't, and maybe, you know, to get absolutely 100%, you should reward the people that really did that work. But the margin that you get by memorizing it is probably not worth as much as the same time spent understanding something else.
Okay.
Right? And if you actually become a professional at doing this, then pretty quickly you become familiar with those. So it's not efficient to require everybody and his brother that's not going to be doing this professionally to memorize all these things. Okay? So how about here? What's that going to be? Okay, it's a doublet because it's split by one hydrogen, two bonds away, or three bonds if you count H to C to H. But in fact, you'll get a little splitting of this one by this one, which is more remote. Normally you don't worry about splitting from that far away, two carbons removed, right? But if it's allylic, you can get some communication through the bonds. It's a little more than you'd expect. So there should be a big splitting by this and a tiny splitting by this. What pattern then would appear? A double doublet, right? A big splitting, but each of those a little bit split. Yeah.
Is that where we get like asymmetrical?
Yeah, and that would be, and if the chemical shift is not so big, wait, that's something else. Now, what are you going to see for this one? First, how about this? What chemical shift for this? Someplace between, it's going to be up, my guess is closer to 1 than 3. It's, these are the ones that are going to be, the ones that are on the sp squared are the ones that are going to be shifted down. These are still sp3, but they're next to that. So there'll be a little electron withdrawal, it'll be shifted down a bit. But okay. And then how about that one? What's it going to be? It'll be a quartet, and also split by this one. Right, and both of these splittings will be substantial. And remember, it's bigger if they're trans than if they're cis. So you could tell cis from trans that way. Okay, and then this one, it'll be mostly a doublet split by that one. But just a teeny bit of each of those doublet things will be a quartet, small splitting. Okay, let's look at the NMR spectrum and see. Pardon me? It's how much this, how much these two are separated from one another. So here's the chemical shift of one, here's the chemical shift to the other.
Oh, it's within the doublet.
But each of them is split. It's within the doublet. That's the one that comes from a difference of how the neighbor is oriented. Okay, so let's look at... do we not have the C13, the proton NMR? Oh, after doing all this, there's not a... Pardon me?
What is the carbon-carbon double bond to the shift on the two hydrogens?
What is the shift? It's down around 3-4. Four probably.
Field,
yeah. Let's go back and look at this neural. Let's see. What's this one? Here's one that's... This has a proton NMR. This is the one we should have done. Okay, this is going to be more complicated. It's more protons, right? But it has these chemical shifts, among others. Right? We searched for things that had these chemical shifts. So it's going to have these. It has more carbon, so it'll have others too. But just as an example of a proton NMR, let's look. How about this? Yeah, it's a little bit below one. How about its splitting pattern? It's going to be a doublet, but each of those doublets will be a little bit split by this one because it's a double bond, so there's a little communication. This one? Some down around 4 or 5, someplace like that, and it's going to be a quartet and a doublet, and the splittings are going to be both fairly big, so that's going to be complicated. How about this proton? It's going to be a doublet, maybe just a little bit of splitting from that one. How about here? Notice we have here's a proton here. It's going to have a chemical shift like those, so this is going to be a little bit complicated spectrum, right? Because there are going to be a lot of things that have similar chemical shift. There's going to be this methyl group. What's its splitting pattern going to be? This methyl group here. Mostly a singlet, maybe just a little bit of splitting from that proton. How about this and this? Same. Right, so this is going to be a complicated spectrum because we're going to have things that are all fairly near one another. Let's look. The question, Mayra?
You have the doublet and then it's like also kind of split by the two bonds away from the other one.
Yeah.
How does that look?
Well, let's look. It may be that it's too complicated to see easily. Here's the spectrum. Okay, and do they have... They may have the picture of the molecule here so we can compare. I think they do. Yeah, here we go. Okay, so this one we talked about is J. Doesn't it say J? J is at... It's this one. 1.87, right? 1.87. It's one of these. Now there's a problem here. I want to look at some of these others. The problem is, in the old days, these things looked easier, looked simpler to interpret. The reason is, these are perfectly good, but you have to expand the scale to see. Because here, this is measured at high field. Let's see, what did they say what frequency the spectrometer was? Let's see. It's 400 megahertz. Right, four times as big a field as the 100. The first NMR spectra I took were at 40 megahertz. Right, and then 60 was what we used when I was a graduate student mostly. When I came down here, it was 100 became the gold standard. But now it's something like that. What this means is that the chemical shift is very big. Remember, it goes with, you measure it in parts per million, a fraction of the field. So the peaks are really separated, which is good. But if you have a scale that shows all these peaks, the spin-spin splitting, which is always the same in energy, appears very small on that scale. So it's very hard to see what... You can see here that this is a doublet, but it's only one pixel apart. What pattern is this? Can you see? It's 1 to 3 to 3 to 1, I think. So it's a quartet. But it looks like they might be doublets, although that might just be the resolution of the screen. You know, if we could spread this out, and maybe you can, I don't know. Is there a way of doing that?
Yeah,
Is there a thing about zooming in or something? Does anybody see? I bet there's a way to zoom in, but I don't see it. I don't want to spend a lot more time on it. But let's. But these things are. That's a triplet there. It's a pity that, I mean, you know, they paid a lot of money to get a 400 megahertz spectrometer, right? But if we can't expand the scale, we can't profit from it. Yeah.
Do you have two fingers scrolling on your computer? You can.
But it won't, and I don't on this computer. But it's not going to. But even if I expanded it, it would just make things wider. It wouldn't increase the resolution, I don't think. Now let's go back. I'm sorry that this hasn't proved to be. But I can assure you that what's going to happen is that you were very close to right in interpreting the spectrum. But this isn't a very good one to look at. So let's go back to that one we just looked at.
Can you just draw the double?
Pardon me?
Can you just draw the double, like on the board?
Yeah. If it were like that one that was, that one proton, remember, was this. We had this thing here. This coupling is much bigger than this coupling. So if you didn't have that and just had this interaction and looked at that proton, you'd see a doublet. Except on that spectrum that we just looked at, they'd be on top of one another practically. You wouldn't see it because of the scale. Okay, but now this is also, so this is, we're looking always at this proton, and this one is coming from molecules where this is oriented one way, and this is coming from molecules where that one happens to be pointed the opposite way. So it's a doublet. Everybody with me on that? Okay, but now you're going to have some of those molecules that have this one oriented so as to give that peak will have all three of these oriented the same way. Won't have a very big effect this far away, but it'll have some effect. So it'll be a peak out here, say. Okay? The first proton here affected it to shift it from the average position to here. These three, all reinforcing that, shift it just a little bit further down. Right? Now there are going to be others where these three are all the other way, and they're going to give it here. Okay? And then there are going to be some where two of these are up and one is down, and that's going to be here and here. So it's a quartet. But the same thing happens here. Sorry. 1, 3, 3, 1. So what this is a doublet of quartets. Okay? And that appears in that spectrum we just saw, but it's hopeless to see it because we don't have the... Let's see if this other spectrum is... Oh, we don't have the spectrum of the other one, but we have its C13 spectrum. Let's see, we got to go back.
Professor?
Yeah?
The other one, the splitting caused by... Oh, never mind.
Okay. Now, let's look at this. What we got to this by trying to figure out what the C13 spectrum was we looked at. Okay. Now, so here's the C13 spectrum, and now compare that with the decoupled spectrum that you have, right, in that thing. And what you'll see is it's just right. Right. Here's the, which won't surprise you, because we put in those chemical shifts and it found this, and it's got all the same chemical shifts, just right. Does everybody see that on looking at the spectrum? However, there's one thing that's wrong about this compared to what showed in the first, the coupled spectrum, right? So, let's see, we got to get it further down to see the assignment here. Oh, here. No, let's do that as a guess. Okay, now here are the peaks. And it's the carbons, right? So we got... these are hydrogens. Okay, so we got a carbon here. Where does but we have a carbon here, right? The carbonyl group. Where does that come? Anybody got an idea? It's shifted way down. That's this one. Okay, I'm not expecting you to do C13 spectra. Although, I mean, not to know this part, but my point in assigning this and forgetting to mail it to you, I'm sorry, is that you could look at this, and given time and working in a group, you could see what would fit with what. And you can look up other molecules that have that chemical shift, and you'd find out that the ones that have that chemical shift are all esters. C double bond O with an O next door. So that's how you know that that's an ester when you see that. Okay. Then you have these two. Where are those going to come? Anybody know? It's these two, right? Double bonds. The double bonded ones are shifted way downfield too. Right? And then you have, what do you think this one is? That's shifted downfield compared to the others. Pardon me? Carbon 5.
4.
It's carbon. It's carbon 4, which has an oxygen on it. Okay, and then you have. Wait a second. Have I done something wrong here?
Might the 4 come before the 2? Because there's an oxygen next to it, and there's no oxygen next to the 2.
No, because it turns out, if you go through this database and look at a bunch of these things that have double bonds, you find the double bonds come in this thing, and the ones that have oxygens next to them come up here. Okay. 5. Yeah, 5 is. Oh yeah, that's right. So now 5 and 6 are the ones that are left here, and one of them is, this is 5, and this is 6. Okay, so everything looks great. Okay, for this being that compound, except for one thing in the first slide. I should have gotten it up on mine so you could see it. Which lecture is it again? 60? What?
61.
Okay, so it's loaded here now. Let's go. No, it's not. Oh, 61. I've got 62. Yeah, here we go. So here is there's the decoupled spectrum. Let me show you this first. Or wait, maybe this is okay. So we've got the carbonyl had no hydrogens on it, not split. This one had a single hydrogen on it, the double bond. Remember, it had a methyl group and a single hydrogen. This one had a single hydrogen. That looks good. This was the CH2 next to the oxygen. That looks good. This was the CH2. All right, that's sorted. This is the CH3, which is on one end of the molecule on the double bond. And on the other end of the molecule, in the thing we were just looking at, on the other end of the molecule here, here's a CH3, and this is a CH3. But in our spectrum that we used in class, it was CH2. So there's a hydrogen missing. So all the chemical shifts are just right. That's pretty strong evidence that we've got pretty much the right structure, except that it's a CH2 at the end of the molecule rather than a CH3. This thing here. How could that be CH2 rather than CH3? Any ideas? There's another valence. What's attached to that valence? Tell me what you're thinking about, Young. What could be attached to that other valence other than... So this thing looks like a CH3 here. Are you okay with me on that? But the spectrum said it was CH2, that there were only two protons splitting it. Ah, deuterium. That's a good idea. That would do the trick, right? Except, and it's perfectly good, but it's not so likely that that was the compound they were looking at. But it's a good idea. You'd get full credit for that. Okay? So it could have been a deuterium that's on here. How would you know? You could look at the proton spectrum and see whether there was what that was. Or even better, you could look at the deuterium NMR spectrum and see if there's any deuterium in there. Okay? So that's a possibility that's a deuterium. But there's another one that's possible too, which is that the molecule is actually two of these linked together through this number six carbons. Right? Then you'd have the right splitting. And those peaks and only those peaks. And I don't know what the true structure is. I wish if we had a proton. See, the proton NMR spectrum would be quite different if you had two of these linked together. Because if it's a CH2 deuterium split by the two H's here, it's a triplet. But if it was the dimer molecule, then this CH2 would be next to this CH2, but also next to this CH2. It would be split by four protons and be a five-line pattern. So if you had other... IR wouldn't be very helpful for that. What would you look for in the IR spectrum of this? Yeah, the carbonyl stretching, and where would you expect it to come? Compared to a normal ketone.
Farther to the left.
Remember,
higher frequencies.
Yeah, remember the ester comes at a little higher frequency, which surprised us a little bit. Right? It also has a double bond here, which is in resonance with the C double bond O conjugation. That would lower it a little bit, so be a little in between. But anyhow, they're characteristic IR stretching frequencies for that kind of thing, and you'd look that up in a table and so on. So that's how nowadays you'd probably do real spectroscopy, is you have some unknown. And unknowns are rarely completely unknown. You know, you've been making something, you knew what the starting material was, so you know some of the things that are there. So you take a spectrum, you look and try to interpret it. You go to a database like this one and look at related molecules, see what chemical shifts they have and so on. So that's how it's done nowadays. You don't have to memorize these tables. Yeah, Abhi? Yeah. Then this coupling, that doublet would get a little bit smaller. Okay? And remember, you can also tell whether it's cis or trans from the IR, those two hydrogens. Remember what it is that you look for there? Henry?
Trans arrangements on to the brightness spectrum.
They're either the right or the left.
They're weaker in terms of.
Now, when they're trans and moving the same way, you're twisting the double bond. When they're cis and moving the same way, you're not twisting the double bond. So it's harder to do this. It's harder when they're trans. It's higher frequency. So it's less 980 or something like that compared to 800 or something like that. I forget what. Yeah.
Along the same lines, that one experiment where the for IR where they added they exposed it to what was it? I forgot exactly, but it showed that there were cis and trans isomers in the sample. Like I think was it radiation? I'm not sure.
This is when you the visual pigments. Which are there? The retinal? That you, is that the one you're talking about?
The one where it was like, it was. I think it was in the second lecture at the end.
The one where they did it at real low temperature,
yeah.
And saw the complicated spectrum. Yeah, it was whether the it was, but that was. Was it two carbon? It was a carbonyl and a double bond like this, right? And they could, but they could be cis or trans to one another. Wasn't that it? It was something like that. S cis or S trans. That is, rotate 180 degrees about that bond. Christine, do you remember? That one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do that. Anybody remember the lecture number for that one? It was probably 57, you think? Yeah, I think this is it. The end of this one. Yeah, here.
Yes.
Okay, so that was the spectrum. And you're going to have, in this region here, you have, for stretching, you have both the CO double bond, but also CC double bond. Right? But there are three peaks there, or maybe four. Okay, so this they generated this methyl vinyl ketone, right? It's a ketone. One group is methyl, the other group is the double bond that's vinyl, methyl vinyl ketone, in argon at 13 Kelvin, and they got that spectrum. And then, oops, it's running itself. Let me slow it down so. Okay, then they shined light on it for 2.5 hours, and they get not this spectrum. This spectrum is the difference between the new spectrum and the old spectrum. So it's the new spectrum minus the old spectrum. So if nothing changed, what would you get? You'd get a flat line. But now you get peaks from things that grew during that irradiation, and valleys from things that went away because you subtracted them.
What does radiation do to the heat?
So the light gets absorbed by this, so you get energy in there, which becomes heat, which allows it to move a little bit. Now, and typically, a thing like this, if you irradiate long enough, you get to what's called a photostationary state. That means it's not changing anymore with light. Okay, and you put energy in by its absorbing light. One of them absorbs light more strongly than the other. These two isomers. Okay, it would be difficult to predict which one is more, but it's not surprisingly they're a little different, right? So initially they're both there. One absorbs more strongly than the other. It gets excited, rotates, and gives some of the other one and some of itself after it's rotated. Okay? But the other one is doing the same thing. But one is absorbing more than the other. So you have a net flow from one to the other until the ratio of the two is such that they're both absorbing the same amount of light. Because one absorbs more strongly, but there's less of it. And once they're both absorbing the same amount of light, then you're stuck. That's how they go back and forth. Okay, so these peaks aren't all coming from the same molecule. There's one molecule that's giving this peak and this, and another molecule that's giving this and this. And then they did a lot of calculations and stuff to see where peaks should come. Good quantum mechanical calculations, or more or less reliable quantum mechanical calculations, and what they found was that this molecule in that conformation is calculated to give peaks at those two positions. So this is close to that, this is close to that, so that's what grew when you shined light on it, right? Now, what's the other thing, the thing that went away? These are the calculated positions for this double bond, carbon-oxygen, carbon-carbon double bond. It's got a very strong peak here. I drew it pointing down because it was disappearing, right? It was in the original spectrum and not in the new spectrum so much. right? And this peak is very weak. Now, this one is mostly CC vibration. This is mostly CO vibration, right? But the one that's mostly CC vibration, they're mixed, right? But the one that's mostly CC, turns out the dipole moment that's changing here mostly cancels the dipole moment that's changing here. So there's very little net change in dipole moment. Whereas up there, they reinforced one another in that mode so that you got a stronger peak. But anyhow, that shows that this allowed you to see that there were two compounds that were interconverting with one another and to identify what they were. Yeah?
Why is the CO peak so negative?
Well, how negative it is, well, I mean, I drew it that way. Right? Why is it this negative? This is the experiment. Right? That's how much of it went away. There was a big peak to begin with, and much of it went away. So whatever was positive here is negative when you subtract this from the new spectrum. This one is the S trans.
Yeah, like on the bottom thing, is 6096 the S trans, or is?
Yeah.
And then what's the S?
And the blue ones are that compound, the S cis. Right, and there should be four peaks here. Right, but in fact, there are four, but one of them is really tiny. And this peak, I don't know what it is. It might be some impurity or something. It's something that went away. And maybe it's somehow associated. Maybe there's another, although it's hard to see what other isomer there could be of these things for rotation. Anyhow, that's the main peaks. Is that clear, Christine? You didn't sound really convinced that it was clear. What?
No, it's clear.
Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea. Did you get the email I sent you about that?
Yeah.
That wasn't very clear. Okay, so let's just go through this again. Okay, so here's the first one, right? It's simple. We stretch it and let it vibrate, and it vibrates back and forth. Okay, that's fine. And it has a given frequency, and it's independent of the other one. Okay, then I don't know what's it's because I deactivated it. I don't know. Maybe it's partially animated itself. Okay, I can't remember how to run this.
You just press on,
right,
and it moves on.
Yeah, it moves on. Okay, now this one is coupled to a frozen partner, right? So the partner isn't moving. It's not very realistic, unless the partner were really, really heavy. Okay? But we have this extra spring that comes from its interaction with the other one. Okay? Now that means the frequency is going to be higher because it's harder to stretch when you're stretching that intermediate spring as well as the original spring. Okay? So the frequency is different. Okay? And now if you let both of them go this way, I forget how I animated it. Yeah. Okay, then they're moving without stretching the intermediate spring. Sorry. Yeah, there. Okay. So it's the same frequency it had originally. It's as if the other one wasn't there. But the out-of-phase coupling, does that one go automatically too? No, this one I have to, I guess, poke the buttons. I can't remember. Okay, that one is stretching the intermediate spring. Okay, so that's going to be harder. In fact, it's stretching the intermediate spring twice as much as it did when the other one was fixed. Okay, so that's going to be this. Okay? Now, oh, maybe I didn't show. Maybe I didn't animate it. Okay, so there you're mixing them. So there's an in phase and an out of phase compared to the one where the other one was fixed and you just had the spring in the middle. Right? And I drew it this way to point out the analogy, which is a strict mathematical analogy between the energies of orbitals and the coupled things you get from them due to overlap, the bond and the antibond. Okay? Yeah, so the two independent ones corrected for the fact that there was a spring. That is, when you held this one rigid and moved this one, so it did have to stretch the spring. But when they're coupled, you either don't stretch the spring or you stretch it twice as much. So you get one that's higher and one that's lower is the one that's the normal stretching of the spring. Okay? And it's just like... It's the same mathematics. It's just like forming a bond between two orbitals. And what I demonstrated in class, I think, but I don't think I have on here, is when the two weights are different. And that's the thing you're interested in. This is a superposition of two modes of a different frequency. So when the two have a different frequencies, one's heavier than the other, right? Then it's like mixing two orbitals that have different energy. You get a sum and a difference. One of them is mostly this and only a little bit of the other one. One is mostly the other one and a little bit of this. But one is moved to higher frequency and one to lower, right? One went down, one went up. Okay? So both of them are moving at the same frequency. In both modes, that is, in this mode, the in phase, they're both moving, but one's moving much more than the other one. And in the other one, this one's moving mostly, and this one a little bit, and opposite. And the reason they can be moving at exactly the same frequency is because of that spring that's between them. It's that spring, the spring that's between them, in one case, makes the slow one a little faster and the fast one a little slower because of the way they're moving, whether that spring is helping them move or hurting them. And the other one, it does it the other way.
Okay, so why did you show the superposition of two
molecules? If you actually could look at the molecule and see the atoms moving, it would look like nothing. I mean, things are just like that. They're just moving. They would seem to be at random. But you can analyze that motion into the superposition of normal modes where the atoms are moving at the same frequency. In this particular case here, we saw that weird thing where one of them is vibrating, then it slows down and the other one vibrates. And then it slows down and the first one vibrates. It seems to go back and forth, which really looked weird, right? But what was happening was that was the superposition, the simultaneous motion of this and this. Right? And for one, say you add this to this, which cancels here and reinforces here. So this one is moving a lot and this one's not moving very much. But after a little while, they get out of phase with one another because this one has a higher frequency than this one does. So after a while, the things that added subtract. So now this one's not moving and this one's moving a lot. And then you wait that time again and they add again rather than subtracting and now this one's going. So when you look at the superposition of two things, you see very funny things happening. This moves, then this moves, and then this moves. But if you looked at the normal modes underneath it, you'd see one of them was just this, and the other one was just this. Does that help?
Yeah.
Sharif?
So could the normal modes be thought of being gradients for the motion?
Yeah. So you can always analyze any dynamic system like that into normal modes, and any arbitrary motion of that system is some sum of the normal modes of it. Yeah.
Do you mind if we go back quickly and see 13 spectrum?
Yeah?
Just like, to summarize, like what we were doing. So we looked first at the structure and then at like the different carbons. And we were guessing based on other structural elements in the molecule, like bond types and major neighboring atoms, like how deshielded the electrons in the carbon would be.
Right.
And so from that, we predicted what the peaks might be. Yes.
Yeah.
We compared that to the.
Yeah, there are two ways to do it. To start with a particular structure and predict what the spectrum should be, or you could start with the spectrum and try to figure out what the structure was that gave that spectrum. And we did both things here on the board, right? I went through and I said, where would you expect that one? 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 Right? And then we did it by starting with a spectrum, that one that was the green lines on the black. You read out to me what the chemical shifts were. I entered them in the database, and it came back with something that had that. Right? And you could have substituted yourself from the database for the database if you had memorized the table of C13 chemical shifts, what kind of, you know, carbonyl comes at to what at 168 or whatever it was, right?
All right.
And then you have additional information. You have the spin-spin splitting, how many protons there are on each carbon, right? Which either when you're trying to predict a spectrum, you say, aha, this one should be a doublet, this one should be a triplet, this one should be a double doublet, right? Or you have you see it in the spectrum and say, aha, that one has two hydrogens on it, this one has four hydrogens on it, three hydrogens on it, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So the fundamental information you have to go from is the chemical shift, the spin-spin splitting, and in the case of a proton spectrum, you have something else that's very important. The integral. How many of protons there are of that kind.
That's only in 13.
You can do it somewhat in the C13 spectrum, but many C13 spectra, especially if they're being decoupled, the intensities can get all messed up. It's much better for protons where it's very reliable, the integral. Yeah?
With the electrophilic substitution to the enzyme, why do you have to go from nitro to NH2 to N2+? Why can't you just go from nitro group to N2+ straight without the NH2?
Because there isn't a reagent that does that. There's a way of converting NH2 to N2+, but there isn't a way of converting NO2 to N2+, except by first making it into NH2 and then converting that into N2+, because there are reagents that do that. And we looked at we didn't look at the mechanism for going from NO2 to NH2. That's a reduction reaction that's rather complicated. But we did look in some detail at the mechanism of going from NH2 to N2+. By way, remember what the intermediate was? It was NHNO2. And then you have to remove the H and the O to get to N. You remove OH minus, and it becomes then N2+. Right? But of course you can't remove O from here and H from here just like that and have it be hydroxide. What you have to do is put a proton on the oxygen. Take this proton off, allylic rearrangement. Then you want to take this hydroxide off. But hydroxide is not that great a leaving group. What do? Protonate it and lose water.
So you need to put in acid for that to happen.
Put in what?
Acid.
Yeah, but that's what you have. The reaction's done in nitrous acid. That's the reagent you're using. It all happens at once.
Right.
Yeah. It's the witching hour. If there's a last question, I'll entertain it, but otherwise we'll... Yeah, sure.
A few slides down, we talk about 3N-6. I didn't completely understand that.
Yeah, any given atom has three Cartesian coordinates, right? So you could say it vibrates in X, it vibrates in Y, it vibrates in Z. when it's connected to something else, you talk about stretching the bond, rotating the thing, and so on. But still, to specify it, you have three coordinates per atom. Three XYZ for this one, XYZ for this one. If you have N atoms, it takes 3N coordinates to tell the structure. Right? Now, that means there are 3N types of motion that would change the structure. If it takes 3N to tell it, you could change any one of them. So there are 3N kinds of motion. But in a molecule, they're linked together. It's not just this moving in XYZ. What a molecule can do is all the atoms can move together this way. That's just motion. All of them can move this way. All of them can move this way as a group. That's not vibration. It just keeps going if it starts going. So those are not vibrations. Those coupled motions of the thing rigid are not vibrations. So you have 3N types of motion, coordinated motion, minus 3 because you don't count this, this, and this. But there are three others you don't count too. That's rotation of the thing when it's rigid. And it can rotate around this axis, it can rotate around this axis, and it can rotate around the third axis. So there are three rotations you don't count as vibration. So there are three translations, as you call it, the whole thing moving rigidly. There are three rotations. So of the 3N possible coordinated motions, X, Y, Z for everything, that all mixed together, of the 3N, there are three that are translation and three that are rotation, and the remaining 3N minus 6 are vibrations. So there are 3N minus 6 vibrations for a molecule that has N atoms. But not all of them will be active in the IR because some of them don't change the dipole moment, so they don't interact with light in that way. But remember that website we looked at also had Raman spectra. And those can show vibrations like breathing that don't appear in IR because it's a different technique that's doing it. Okay, so that'll do it.
Thank you.
Are you going to send us that the audio files?